Welcome to the podcast for Healing Neurology, where we talk about everything that can help heal your neurology, which is really everything from food, lifestyle, and medicine to nature, culture, and politics. There's no topic too big or too small. I'm Jillian Ehrlich, family nurse practitioner, certified in Ayurveda and functional medicine. And today we have a guest, a type of guest we don't often have, PhD, as opposed to clinical practitioner. Dr. Alessandro Bitto is an acting assistant professor in the Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology at the University of Washington. His research is focused on understanding the interaction between biological aging, mitochondrial function, and metabolic disease. He completed his PhD at Drexel University in Philadelphia in cellular senescence. Dr. Bitto is a postdoctoral fellow on the Genetic Approaches to Aging Training Grant from 2013 to 2016, and the recipient of a postdoctoral research award from the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation. He's been awarded a KO1 Career Development Award from the National Institute of Diabetes, Digestive, and Kidney Diseases to investigate targeting longevity pathways to treat and prevent obesity. Dr. Bitto, welcome. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the invitation. Just a little correction. I am not yet an acting assistant professor, but I will be as of May 1st.
May 1st, yes.
I'm almost there. Almost there. That's when the grant kicks in, so they give me a raise.
Yeah, perfect.
And a promotion.
Good.
Technically a reappointment, but whatever. Doesn't matter.
Okay. I mean, I feel like this podcast, you know, we are airing it in February of 2022, but it will be available for a long time. So by the time people listen to it in May, then it will be accurate.
It'll be correct. Yes.
It'll be correct.
Perfect.
All right. So the things that you study in the lab are the things that we talk a lot about in clinical practice. So biological aging, mitochondrial function, metabolic disease, that is pretty much encapsulates a lot of what we do at Center for Healing Neurology and that a lot of progressive clinicians are doing across the country. So let's dive into this today from the research perspective. And we're not going to ask you clinical questions, but to go right from the research and let's start kind of at the top with your training. What can you describe or define for us? What is cellular senescence in general terms? Cells age. What does that mean from the research perspective?
So cellular senescence is an interesting phenomenon that was initially described in the late 50s, early 60s of the 20th century. Seminal experiments were done by researcher by the name of Leonard Hayflick. Mm-hmm. And what he found out was that primary cells, so cells that you have taken out of an animal and started culturing in a petri dish and that have not been immortalized by any means, so not treated like with not, they're not cancerous cells, they have not been modified genetically, those cells, they will only replicate in your petri dish and a finite number of times. And at some point, they will stop dividing. And he called that process cellular senescence. And back in the day, he made the hypothesis that this phenomenon that you can see from the cells in vitro, that they divide, and at some point, they stop dividing, was like one feature, one possible explanation of why we age or why the body ages. Now, so like the idea is that if your cells explanted from your body can only divide so many times, then the cells in your body will probably like do something similar, the same. This is not exactly true, but it was a good initial guess. The truth of the matter is that cellular senescence is a kind of stress response that the cells use, the human cells and animal cells use now to respond to external or internal stressors. So, and the way it works is that the cell decides to stop dividing and change its activity in order to prevent going down a dark path, in a sense. So preventing, for example, tumorigenic transformation. The cellular senescence is a mechanism to prevent cancer. A cell gets hit with DNA damage. The DNA damage could cause mutations that could become cancerous. The cell decides to close shop. We're not going to divide anymore. And we're just going to change our morphology and our behavior so that the immune system can recognize us and come and take us out. So that's in like a few words, basically, what the phenomenon is. The interesting thing is that for the longest time, we didn't think that these cells were present in vivo, like in actual organisms. There was some people for the longest time thought that the cellular senescence was just a tissue culture artifact, something that you just see when you expand cells and you culture them outside of the body into plastic petri dishes. But the reality of the matter is that cells that have markers of cellular senescence have been identified in animals, in mice, in primates, in a sense, maybe even in humans. And there's been some functional experiments that have shown that if you get rid of those cells in a live organism, for example, in a live mouse, you can make the mouse live longer or at least a healthier life. So they are now one of the so-called hallmarks of aging, which is a number of biological phenomena that we think are impacting biological age.
So few questions, lots of thoughts. So if cellular senescence, so if we think of this as a stress response, then is mediated, essentially autophagy or the elimination of cells is mediated by the immune system. Why do cells in a petri dish die? Like if they have everything they kind of need, why do they die?
So one of these kind of stresses is the so-called erosion of telomeres. So the problem with there's a fundamental problem with DNA replication in animals because animals have linear chromosomes. Mm-hmm. So when you have a linear chromosomes, you are unable to replicate the end of the chromosomes, which are called telomeres, faithfully with each round of replication. With each round of replication, they become shorter and shorter and shorter. It's like sharpening a pencil. Each time you sharpen a pencil, the pencil becomes shorter, right? At some point, when the cells divide in vitro, and they keep on dividing because you're giving them the stimuli to divide, so you're giving them growth factors in the form of serum, otherwise they would not be growing. With each round of replication, it becomes shorter and shorter and shorter. At some point, one of the chromosomes would become short enough that there would be no more telomeres, and instead it would be an end of a chromosome exposed, and that will trigger a DNA damage response. And the DNA damage response is what triggers the senescence transition.
And so even in a petri dish where there's, you know, per se, no immune system to kind of come and take the cell out, the cell does it itself?
Well, the cell will become senescent. There will not be an immune system to come and take out the senescent cells. Mm-hmm. But the cells will become senescent. Now, here is where we kind of like go from what we know to what our hypotheses are. But like the idea is that cells will become senescent in the body pretty much all the time. For one reason or another. And the erosion of telomeres is not necessarily the reason why they become senescent. So you can hit cells in culture with, say, hydrogen peroxide, and they will become senescent because you're triggering a DNA damage response. You can give them, you can try and insert oncogene. You can insert like a mutated gene that causes cancerous proliferation in these cells, and they will become senescent, et cetera. So there's different ways of doing it, and they all converge most of the times onto a DNA damage response. The cells will become senescent. If this happened to a cell in the body and there's a healthy immune system, the healthy immune system will go find a cell and take it out. As you get older, your immune system doesn't work as well. This is kind of like here we are in the realm of hypothesis that we are kind of testing. As you get older, your immune system doesn't work as well. And so those senescent cells accumulate and they start causing damage, because what they do is that they produce a number of factors, and a lot of these factors are actually pro-inflammatory. There's a lot of cytokines that these cells spit out, they secrete, and that will change the microenvironment where they are and alter the function of the tissue where they are. So that's the idea. So finding ways of removing these cells without using the immune system, for example, that is not able to find them anymore when you're older, is a way of preventing some aging associated damage. And there's a whole part of aging research that is actually focused on that. It's not what I am doing personally because I'm not working on that anymore. But there's a lot of people associated with the Mayo Clinic in Rochester and in other centers. But the Mayo Clinic was the first place because it's a fellow by the name of James Kirkland, who have developed a number of drugs, a class of drugs they call senolytics. So these are drugs that target and kill senescent cells. So there's a lot of interest over this class of drugs and what they can do and if they can make you age more gracefully.
Can you name some of those senolytic drugs? Do you know those?
So the first generation of senolytics were two drugs. One of them is a natural compound called quercetin. And then the other drug is called dasatinib. Mm-hmm. And then there's a second generation senolytics. One drug is called fizetin. I don't know how to pronounce it. These are drugs that have shown the ability to deplete senescent cells, and they have done some very interesting studies. I think that they are not very targeted. They have like a broad spectrum of activity. They need to be dosed properly also in the mice because they could be very toxic. So I'm looking at this research with great interest. I'm a big fan of cellular senescence. I've been working on it for many years, but I'm also wary. I know that there's people that have decided to like start taking these drugs. now from the hype of this result and these studies. And I am very, very wary of what they're doing, because now it's very easy that they end up poisoning themselves instead of like just taking out the senescent cells.
Interesting. And were those drugs developed? Was cellular senescence their initial target?
No, it wasn't. Actually, you know what? I think, let me just look it up real quick. I think dasatinib was used for, so then the brand name Sprycel is a targeted therapy medication used to treat certain cases of chronic myelogenous leukemia.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's basically a chemotherapeutic in a sense.
So quercetin is, you know, initially from, I mean, it's in apples, it's in grapes, it's in lots of plants. And we commonly use that to stabilize mast cells in mast cell activation disorder. So that's a supplement that is over the counter.
Yeah, it's true, but it's really the combination of the two that really did the magic in those initial studies.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder how they picked quercetin as a complement.
I don't remember exactly the literature. I think they kind of ran like a screen. So they got senescent cells, they treated them with a number of compounds. They saw what was working. These two drugs were having, and I might not remember exactly well what happened, but each of these drugs were having a partial effect, and they decided to put them together and they had a good effect. And so they decided to go with that.
Can you talk a little bit about how different cells age differently in the body? Like certainly cells of the gut, you know, are replaced much more frequently than neurons. Can you talk a little bit about those different times?
So yeah, I mean, here we touch on something that is a little bit different than cellular senescence. So one question that I think is still open is which kind of cells do senesce, right? And which kinds don't? And also what happens to the kind of cells that don't senesce if that's the senescence associated with the so-called germinal layer of those cells. So in very broad strokes, you can think of the cells in your body as part of like three different families in a way. So you have like epithelial cells, like in your skin, or like as you was mentioning, your gut. Now, those are all cells that are easily replaceable. They're not very long-lived. You usually have a germinal layer at the bottom where you have so-called stem cells that regenerate cells that have the function. For example, in the gut, there's intestinal stem cells that make those colonocytes, now as we call them, all the time. The colonocytes then serve the function, absorb the nutrients. At some point, they die, they get replaced by another one. In the skin is a clear example. You have a germinal layer in the dermis. Now it keeps on making your keratinocytes. They come up, they become full with keratin, they die, they flake off, and that's a continuous process, right? Mm-hmm. So one thing that some people are working on and are thinking about is, does the germinal layer eventually become senescent? And so you are unable to replenish your tissues as much. That's another one of the things that we think cellular senescence is involved in, just like destroying that regenerative capacity of the body, right? Mm-hmm. It's something that happens for example, a lot with the muscles. As you get older, your muscle stem cells, which are called satellite cells, they're less able to regenerate your muscle fibers. For example, if you have injuries or things like that. And there's a lot of research there working with soluble factors. So you may have heard about some experiments of so-called heterochronic parabiosis, where they were joining together a young mouse and an old mouse and then giving a muscle injury to the old mouse. And the blood from the young mouse or something in the blood from the young mouse was able to regenerate the muscle of the old mouse better than the blood from the old mouse. Right? So the germinal layer could be something that gets affected by cellular senescence. Your epithelium, not quite, because it doesn't quite have that kind of dynamic, doesn't quite live long enough. And then you have these very long-lived cells like your neurons, which kind of stay there almost forever, although they also can be replaced a little bit. There is still some proliferative activity in the neurons. And you also have all the supporting structure in the brain. So astrocytes, and astrocytes can senesce, for example. That's something that we did actually a little while ago. And then people have worked on after our initial discovery when I was in grad school. Your immune cells, sometimes they can undergo cellular senescence, especially the precursors of your differentiated T cells and B cells, et cetera. So I don't know if that answers the question. But basically, yes. So depending on the kind of cell, no, either they don't really age because they are continuously recycled, no, or if they are the ones that make the cells that are then recycled or are part of that long lip pool, they can then undergo senescence and then stop working properly. The classic type of cell that that undergoes senescence, the cells that Leonard Hayflick was working with were fibroblasts, mm-hmm. which are cells in your skin and around your organs that kind of like lay down that extracellular matrix that supports the parenchyma of your organs. No?
And so those are part of the fibroblasts are part of the connective tissue, correct?
Yes.
All right. So we talk a lot about connective tissue also because we are finding more and more with hypermobility syndromes or Ehlers-Danlos that people can have kind of a wide range of symptoms that are not, don't necessarily appear to be part of the connective tissue, but can have hypermobility syndromes as an associated condition. So even things in the gut, allergic symptoms, if the connective tissue has disorder to it, either genetic or inflammatory, that some of these other conditions ensue. So then for the flip side, just to look at the flip side, can you tell us a little bit about cancer? Like what happens with cancer? What is cancer?
So cancer is...
In a nutshell.
Again, in a nutshell and very broad strokes, it's when the mechanisms that the cells have to act in a coordinated fashion fail. So one of the things, one of the way I look at cancer, and I'm not an oncologist or a cancer researcher, I did a very small stint in prostate cancer when I first came to the States, but it's not my area of expertise. But my understanding of it is that you kind of have this like two-hit hypothesis in a sense. So cells need to have a mutation that will make them proliferate uncontrollably, and then they need to have a mutation that stops the mechanisms that will prevent them from doing that. So they escape, for example, a cell senescence pathway, or they escape apoptosis, which is cell death, programmed cell death. The cell will just like kill itself if it's like damaged beyond repair and risks becoming cancerous. Those are all biochemical mechanisms that are controlled by your genes. And if those genes fail because of mutations, then you cannot undergo that process anymore. And you are one step closer to becoming cancerous, right? Mm-hmm. So cancer is when a cell just escapes the tight regulation that the body puts onto its cells to act in concerted fashion. So you proliferate when you are making those layers, those epithelial layers like your colon or your skin, etc. You don't proliferate when you don't need to be making new layers of something. Now, as a cancer cell is a cell that decides to proliferate even though it's not receiving the signals to proliferate, and it starts proliferating indefinitely.
So we understand cells, senescence, cancer. Can you talk to us a little bit about where mitochondria come into this process? Let's like make a little switch here.
Yeah. So, well, mitochondria are fascinating, first of all. But I'm biased here because I've been working in mitochondria even when I was working with cellular senescence.
Yeah.
But so mitochondria are important in cellular senescence because they can sort of like help go into cellular senescence, or they can help escape it in one way or another. So mitochondria are these little organelles in a cell, so kind of like this small, they're usually depicted as this like kidney-shaped little things inside the cytosol of the cell. They actually exist more in a network, to be honest, when you actually visualize them under fluorescent microscopy. And they are responsible for a number of functions. The most important that everybody knows, and everybody like the classic meme, is the mitochondria are the powerhouse of the cell. So the mitochondria are responsible for making energy, in a sense, for like, rather than making energy, to be more precise, the mitochondria are responsible for storing the energy that we acquire from our nutrients into so-called energy molecules that then are expended by the body to make stuff. And this is usually, this is a molecule called ATP. And the way that the mitochondria does this is by a process called mitochondrial respiration. So it takes the nutrients that we eat and it extracts kind of energy from them. And by consuming oxygen, it kind of stores that energy into ATP. That's one thing that mitochondria do. There's another thing that mitochondria do, which is a lot of so-called intermediate metabolism. So metabolism, again, is divided in two major areas. It's what we call catabolism, which is how we break down stuff. Mm-hmm. So you eat your starches. Starches get broken down into small sugars. The sugars go into a biochemical pathway called glycolysis that breaks down the sugar into smaller molecules, extract energy from that. And then those smaller molecules go into the mitochondria. The mitochondria finishes extracting energy from that, et cetera. Or you eat your fats. The fats are broken down into fatty acids. The fatty acids get transported into the mitochondria. Mitochondria chops them down, extract energy from them. That's the catabolism. Then you have anabolism, which is the body taking the energy that it made from catabolism and the building blocks that it made from breaking down these macromolecules to build its own things. So you can build cellular membranes, you can build new organelles, you can make new cells, replicate your DNA, et cetera, right? And then there's a third part of metabolism, which is so-called intermediate metabolism, which is basically what happens in between these two processes to generate those building blocks that are necessary for anabolism. And a lot of that happens in the mitochondria. Because the mitochondria is where a cycle of metabolic reaction that is called the TCA cycle, so the tricarboxylic acid cycle, also known as the Krebs cycle, because it was discovered by a guy called Krebs, or citric acid cycle by the name of the first compound, the first metabolite in the cycle, at least by the way we have codified it into biochemistry textbooks. This cycle of reactions basically is, in a sense, a hub for everything that you need to make new stuff in the cell. Mm-hmm. So when your mitochondria are not working properly, this TCA cycle is also not working properly. And that comes with a lot of problems, basically. Because then you're not able to build new macromolecules, not to build build sugars, to build lipids, to build protein, to build new nucleic acid, et cetera.
And so what messes with the mitochondria? What are the situations or triggers or conditions that make them not work?
Okay, so one thing that would make them not work, for example, is the two processes that the mitochondria do, so this mitochondrial respiration and the TCA cycle are intertwined, they're connected. So if one of them stops working or doesn't work as well, then the other one is affected. So historically, people have been paying attention a lot to the mitochondrial respiration and to things that affect that mitochondrial respiration. So if you have damages to that process, then you don't produce that you don't produce energy, but you're also stopping the TCA cycle as well. Other ways that you can stop the TCA cycle is that if you're not feeding into it properly. So the mitochondria and the outside and the rest of the cells, so the cytosol, they are not permeable to one another, at least not for everything. There's a lot of transport, active transport happening in between the two, right? So any disruption to that transport could also impact the TCA cycle. Because if you're not able to bring in the molecules, the metabolites you need to feed into the TCA cycle, then the TCA cycle stops running. Or if you're unable to export stuff out of the mitochondria, then you're unable to build proteins, for example, in the cytosol, et cetera, et cetera.
And so the nutrients that are coming in that the mitochondria needs to run the Krebs cycle or the TCA or the citric acid cycle would be the fats, proteins, and carbohydrates, kind of those macronutrients.
Mm-hmm. They all feed into the TCA cycle at different levels.
At different levels. And then also those micronutrients, right? They need like the vitamins and the phytonutrients and those kind of all B12, the vitamins and mm-hmm. minerals.
The vitamins do a different thing. So they don't feed directly into the cycle or into metabolism, at least not all of them. Some of them do, but that's a different story. But the main purpose of the vitamins is to enable that metabolism to happen. A lot of our metabolic enzymes, they use these vitamins, these micronutrients, as so-called cofactors. So just off the top of my head, because I've been thinking about it lately, if I remember well, one entry point to the TCA cycle from glycolysis is an enzyme called pyruvate dehydrogenase. It takes the end product of glycolysis. Glycolysis takes your glucose, so your sugar, breaks it down into, you get two molecules of a small carbohydrates called pyruvate. This pyruvate goes into the mitochondrion, and then it goes into an enzyme called pyruvate dehydrogenase that transforms it into acetyl coenzyme A. And then acetyl coenzyme A goes into the TCA cycle. pyruvate dehydrogenase needs a form of vitamin B2, so pyridoxamine, to function, right? So if you're not taking in the vitamin, you cannot make that enzyme, or at least not make enough of that enzyme. You can have a deficiency in that process.
Okay.
Did I say it right? I think I said it right. I never remember which vitamin does what, but
is B2 is riboflavin? Pyridoxine is B6?
Pyridoxine is B6, probably, yes. You know that better than I do, actually.
But those are, you know, but there's, I think there's a lot of vitamins in the, you know, and a lot of those Bs come into play across the TCA.
Yeah. And, you know, actually let me correct myself, because actually pyruvate dehydrogenase doesn't use B6, but actually uses B1, uses
thiamine. Yeah.
See, I never remember it right. I should remember it right, because that's what I do, but I never do.
That's why we have the Google.
That's why we have the Google. That's right.
So, okay, so we've got our mitochondria and we've got the nutrients coming in and we've got the cofactors and we're kicking out some energy and things are moving along. Can you talk to us a little bit about mitochondria? Like, how do mitochondria and aging work together?
Okay, no, that's another big question. So mitochondria are another one of those so-called hallmarks of aging that I was mentioning earlier. Now, cellular senescence is one, mitochondrial dysfunction, rather, is another one. One of the main so-called theories of aging is what was known as the oxidative stress theory of aging, or free radical theory of aging. There was this fellow, Denon Harmon, back in the first half of the 20th century, but across the first half of the 20th century. He was a medical doctor, and he came up with this theory of aging that basically posits that we are using oxygen when we breathe. The oxygen that we breathe, it then goes into the cells and used by the mitochondria in the process of mitochondrial respiration that I was telling you about. But oxygen is a very reactive molecule. So we have developed ways of dealing with that oxygen and keeping it under control and using it for these metabolic reactions. But oxygen is very reactive. So at one point or another, when the process starts failing, the oxygen will start reacting with things and cause what's called as oxidative stress. You can generate so-called free radicals that then go and damage your macromolecules. You go and damage your proteins, your lipids, you know, your membranes, your nucleic acids even, et cetera, et cetera. And this accumulating damage that become more and more prominent as you get older is the reason why you age. That was his initial theory. A lot of people like that theory. I like that theory too. Again, there's a lot more to that than just that simple phrasing of it. Although he was onto something fundamental over why we age. And mitochondria are the main source of these free radicals, are the main source of this oxidative stress. Just by virtue of the fact that they use that oxygen in that process of mitochondrial respiration, and when that process fails, then things can happen, basically. So any damage or anything wrong with the mitochondria risks causing these free radicals and this oxidative stress that then can cause damage and lead to aging. That's the idea.
You know, with mitochondria, we sort of are in a real pickle, because it's like, if we want to produce less free radicals, it's kind of like, well, could we slow our mitochondria down? But that is a really bad thing. Then we certainly can't intake less oxygen. That's never good. So we need to take in the oxygen and essentially give the mitochondria the raw materials to make oxidative stress free radicals. But then we need to intervene at some other point other than where we intake our oxygen.
Yes, although that is actually something interesting, because if you think, so for a complex organism like us, or anyway, vertebrates, especially mammals, maybe modulating how much oxygen we take in might not be as easy or as straightforward or even possible as a therapeutic option. Mm-hmm. But if you go to first principles, say you take your fibroblasts in your human fibroblasts in culture, mm-hmm. that will senesce after, say, 40 passages. Now, you pass them four times they will do 50 replications doublets. They will divide 50 times, right? Mm-hmm. If you take those very same fibroblasts and you put them in hypoxic environment. So instead of having ambient oxygen tension, which is around 21%, you put them in 5% oxygen tension. Those very same cells will go further, will divide 80 times.
Really?
90 times. Yes. So
at
some level, you can actually modulate longevity by modulating the how much oxygen you have around. That's something you can do, for example, with a model organism that we use in aging research, which is the nematode worm Cynorhabditis elegans. Mm-hmm. It's a small microscopic worm. It's a soil worm. Mm-hmm. It's very tiny. You can kind of see it at the naked eye when they're like full adult, but you can usually look at them under a microscope. You can put those worms into a hypoxic environment and they will live longer. And if you want, also for look at a mammalian organism, there's mouse models of mitochondrial dysfunction, especially a mouse model of mitochondrial disease that actually lives, that usually is very short-lived. And if you put that mouse into a hypoxic chamber, so into a 11% oxygen tension, that animal will live like five times as long. So you can actually modulate oxygen in research and have an effect on longevity. So that kind of speaks to the truth of at least some of what Bennett Harman was seeing.
So some of the interventions that we've used, and you know, that research, I guess, and just in general research has used, are actually giving more oxygen. So hyperbaric oxygen, or even ozone, using ozone for disease. Can you talk to us about why those might be helpful, just in light of what we were just saying?
So I don't know if I really know much about it, to be honest. I think they can be helpful for specific things. So like if you have regions that don't get enough oxygen not to function properly, then like giving oxygen might help. But again, I don't know much about hyperbaric therapy. So I'm not particularly comfortable talking about it without knowing.
Okay. I mean, what you're saying is very true in terms of like, if we bag a foot for a wound, you know, that wound is not going to likely be getting as much oxygenation because those capillaries are destroyed. So that if you give more oxygen, that might be directly applicable.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of off the top of my head. But again, I don't know much of the theory behind it or like the science behind it anyway. So
let's go back to what we were originally talking about, what you and I were originally talking about when I was like, let's have you on the show, which is the work that you're doing now around mitochondria and the microbiome and mitochondria. And can you tell us a little bit about your research, starting with rapamycin and kind of that progression?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So what I'm doing right now, what I have been doing since I came to Seattle and started working at the University of Washington, is I've been working with this very interesting model of mitochondrial disease. The one that I was just telling you about, that if you put it into hypoxia, lives like five times as long. Mm-hmm. This model is very interesting from a biology of aging perspective, because what we've been finding is that interventions that seem to be working in a longevity context, so it's been working, they've been working on wild-type, normal, non-mutant mice, and make them live longer and also healthier or later in life, they seem to be working in this model too. The first example of that was rapamycin. And that was done before I joined the lab that I'm in now. It was done by a previous graduate student who's now assistant professor at Seattle Children's, actually. He gave rapamycin to these mice, and these mice lived three times as long. Mm. So the reason why they did that is actually pretty funny. I didn't go into that when we met 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. But the reason for that, it is a beautiful science story, if you want, because it's a story that starts from a very simple model organism. They started in yeast. And what they did with yeast was, maybe we're opening another can of worms here, but I think it's a very fun story that I want to try and tell it. If you think I'm getting too complicated, let me know, I'll stop.
But, oh, yeah, go for it.
Okay, so the standard of what you can call the standard of care for aging research for longevity is a thing called caloric restriction. Mm-hmm. So basically, you eat less and you live longer, at least for laboratory organisms, that's true. I don't want to get into the details of whether this is true or not for humans, because it's a very complicated subject. It will take an hour just to discuss that. Mm-hmm. But in laboratory animals, in laboratory organisms, that's true for the most part. So you can do that in yeast as well. Yeast, like the baker's yeast, brewer's yeast. And you can look at the replicative lifespan in yeast. So you can look at longevity in yeast. Yeast is particular because it divides asymmetrically. So the mother cell will be bigger than the daughter cell when they divide. You can take the daughter cell away and count how many times a mother yeast cell divides before it stops and dies, right? If you restrict yeast calorically, so you give it less glucose, that yeast will live longer, will make more daughter cells. What they did in the lab, they did a thing that we do a lot in research, which is called a screening. So basically, they looked at the interaction of caloric restriction with mutant of yeast. They knocked out every single gene that they could knock out and still keep the yeast viable. So some knockout genes, if you take away some genes, they're lethal. Now, if you take away DNA polymerase, you don't live. You cannot survive. If you take away a gene in one small mitochondrial function, for example, the yeast is viable. Might not be particularly long-lived, but it still lives, right? What they saw was that the mutants in mitochondrial function, specifically, were some of the mutants that were mostly positively affected by caloric restriction. So where the ones where they had an increase in longevity, their increase in longevity was the biggest with caloric restriction. They weren't necessarily the longest lived, because maybe they were short-lived to begin with. But when you would restrict those yeast mutants, they would gain from caloric restriction more than a normal yeast cell would, right? So what the great thinking was back then was, okay, there's this model, this mammalian model of mitochondrial disease, which is basically a yeast mitochondrial mutant made into a mouse, if you want. Mm-hmm. Let's try and do caloric restriction on that, although we cannot really do caloric restriction on such a tiny, frail mouse that is also developing, because these mice get sick very young. Let's do the next best thing and give them rapamycin. Rapamycin is a drug that inhibits a protein called mTOR. And mTOR is involved in the caloric restriction pathway. So if you are calorically restricted, your mTOR will be less active. So if you give rapamycin, you stop the activity of mTOR. You can think of rapamycin as something that mimics caloric restriction. It's not exactly that. There's distinct properties of the two interventions, but on some level they overlap. So what they did is they gave rapamycin to this mouse model, and lo and behold, it lived a lot longer. So that was a fantastic finding, right? Then I came along. So that paper then is out in Science. Simon Johnson is the first author, if anybody wants to go and find it. I guess it's probably under a paywall, because we don't do ourselves any favor in Science by not making our science available to the public, but whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm fairly sure that it can be found, like the print can be found somewhere, maybe on ResearchGate or whatever. But anyway, I digress. I came along, and in the meantime, other molecules that extend lifespan in normal mice have been found. And one of them was an anti-diabetic drug called Acarbose. Acarbose is an interesting drug because it works in your intestine by preventing you from absorbing your starches, because it prevents your intestinal enzymes, your digestive juices to digest your starches and then absorbing them into the body. And it's used that's why it's used as an anti-diabetic, because it lowers your blood sugar, especially after a meal. So initially they used it for longevity experiments because they thought it was another way of sort of mimicking caloric restriction. Now, if you don't absorb as many starches as you eat, you're going to end up taking less calories in, right? And it was working for longevity. We tried it in this mouse model of mitochondrial disease, and its mechanism of action is completely different from what rapamycin does. And we even looked biochemically at the inhibition of mTOR, and Acarbose is not inhibiting mTOR. Mm-hmm. But Acarbose is also working at making these mice live longer. So we were surprised. We were excited about it. It was fun. It was like, okay, we have a second hit. Because if you have one hit, it's a coincidence. If you have two hits, you start thinking that maybe there's something behind that. No, maybe there are some common mechanisms between aging and mitochondrial disease, at least with this model, right? And when we looked a little further, and one of the things that I was seeing was that the animals that were receiving Acarbose were getting this very large, very big, hypertrophic large intestines. Mm-hmm. They were filled with content. And actually, when you look inside those large intestines, it was all bubbly, like the intestinal content. So we reasoned, and also there's data in the literature that shows that Acarbose can change your intestinal flora. There's actually this drug is in the clinic, is used now clinically to treat diabetes, type 2 diabetes. They've done studies in patients on this drug, and they've shown that it can actually alter your intestinal flora. And it can alter your intestinal flora in ways that is actually beneficial for weight management, for example. So we looked in the mitochondrial disease mice, and there was one particular bacterial genus that was affected, which is called Bacteroides. And the Bacteroides, they seem to be more present in the intestines of the mitochondrial disease mice, whereas if you give a carbose, you could bring that level down considerably. And this also correlated with a change in kind of like a functional aspect of what your intestinal flora does. Because your intestinal flora, what it does is takes everything that is undigested from your body and uses it to survive, to live. But as a byproduct of their metabolism, they spit out these molecules called short-chain fatty acids, which are these volatile, stinky molecules that can actually be used by the body for some metabolic activities. And they actually have other properties like signaling properties. Mm-hmm. So there's very good literature and extensive literature about the impact of the short-chain fatty acids, for example, on the health of the colon. So colonocytes, especially, they seem to be using them not as fuel, as nutrients, but they also are used to influence mitochondrial function. So there's data showing that, for example, one of them, butyric acid, in the colon and in the adipose tissue can stimulate mitochondrial function and mitochondrial biogenesis, which is the process by which we make more mitochondria. Mm. Right? And then that has repercussions over nutrient homeostasis and, for example, can help with obesity, can help lower weight or maintain a healthy weight, for example. Now, this was a pretty long shot, and I don't know, and it's something that I want to do in the future. I just don't have the money for it, but maybe one day I will. I don't know if this short-chain fatty acid makes it all the way to the brain, because this mitochondrial disease model is mostly a neurological model. It has like a lot of brain phenotypes. But we did see a change in the levels of the short-chain fatty acids in the mice treated with acarbose. And by supplementing with a source of one of these short-chain fatty acids, which is butyric acid, we actually saw a modest but was significant extension in longevity and delay in the symptoms of disease. So it's interesting to see. This is all very new, and it's under review right now, so hopefully it will get published soon. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to see how something that you do in your intestine, at least in a mouse model of a disease, and again, it's a model, so it's imperfect, but it's exciting to see that something that you do in intestine can have an effect on what is basically a neurological syndrome. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to like see this work, see the light, and maybe do some more work on it. Because now the next logical step would be to go and alter your intestinal flora, the intestinal flora in these animals directly, and see if we can have some of the same effects that acarbose does. And then very long, very broad picture is that something that happens with aging? Mm-hmm. Is our intestinal flora changing as we get older? And can we change our intestinal flora to a more youthful one? Would that actually help us age more gracefully? So those are kind of the big questions I've been thinking about lately, and I would like to explore.
Interesting. Is there research that you know of between aging and microbiome?
There's a little bit. So microbiome research is sort of like a budding field. Mm-hmm. And it's been for the last 5-10 years. It's really thriving because of sequencing technology. Mm-hmm. Because if you think that before we had the sequencing potential that we have now, so the ability to really go and look at the genetic makeup of what's in our gut, what you had to do was try and culture these organisms, these microorganisms. And the problem is that a lot of them don't like oxygen. They're coming for a circle here. Yeah. But it's true. A lot of the bacteria that you have in your intestine are so-called obligate anaerobes, which means that they don't like oxygen. They do the metabolism without oxygen. Mm-hmm. And oxygen is actually very toxic to them. So you cannot culture them. And if you cannot culture them, you cannot get, by standard means, you cannot get enough of them to look at what's happening. right? But now with modern sequencing, we just need less and less material, starting material, to actually sequence the genetic makeup of your intestine and see what's in there, right? So little by little, we're finding more and more about what's in our intestine and what it does. The big problem is that looking at the genetic makeup of your intestine is one thing. It kind of helps you with phylogeny, so kind of identifying which species are there. It doesn't have a lot of power into telling you what's happening functionally. So which bacteria are doing what and to what extent. Now, and that's where another big data approach can come in handy. It's a thing called metabolomics, where basically you can look at the metabolites in your intestine. Now, so you can see what comes in and what these bacteria spit out from their metabolism and what is used, especially short-chain fatty acid fermentation that I was mentioning earlier. It seems to be a process that is mostly mediated by these bacteria that don't like oxygen. Because if they liked oxygen, if they could use it for respiration, they would have fermented for the short-chain fatty acid, but they would try and break down your macromolecules all the way down to carbon dioxide like we do.
So that's kind of what we know and kind of where we're headed. Can we actually even circle back a little bit more? I know usually we do like, how'd you get interested in this at the beginning of the show? Can you talk to us a little bit about your early work with yeast and mitochondria and alpha-synuclein?
Oh, God. That goes a long way back. Okay.
I know.
So that was, what was that? That was 2006. That was I was a really, really young kind of master student. So I did my training in Italy before my PhD. So my university, my college, technically it's not college, university, but anyway, my undergraduate was all in Italy. And I took advantage of a student exchange scholarship that the European Union gives out to go and do 1 year of study abroad in Belgium, where I worked at the KU Leuven, so the Catholic University at Leuven. So it's one of the oldest universities in Europe. It's not the oldest. We have that one. It's in Bologna, but it's one of the oldest and most famous. And there I worked with a researcher, a professor, his name is Joris Winderix. And he had this project. This is actually how I got into aging research in the first place, because it was just fascinating. He had this very interesting project going on where he had transformed yeast. So he had inserted a human gene, so the human gene for alpha-synuclein, which is a protein involved in Parkinson's disease. He had inserted that into yeast and made this transgenic yeast expressing alpha-synuclein. Why would you ever do that, right? I mean, yeast doesn't have a brain. How does that even matter to Parkinson's disease? It does. And the reason for that is, and this is the beauty of biology in a sense, yeast has a lot of the same fundamental cellular biology that humans do. Just kind of like to prove the point, you can think of a process as basic as the cell cycle, which is basically the process by which a cell grows and then decides to divide into two cells. It's fundamental biology, one of the first things you learn when you do cell biology. That process is regulated, like everything, by genes that make proteins. And the genes in yeast that make proteins that regulate the cell cycle in yeast are the very same that make proteins and regulate the cell cycle in humans. They are so similar and they're evolutionarily conserved that if you take the human genes and you put them in yeast, they work just fine and vice versa.
Wow.
That's how conserved that mechanism is.
Wow. Okay.
So the fundamental biology of yeast and human, fundamental cell biology is the same. So if you want to ask a question about the fundamental biology of what's happening with this protein involving Parkinson's disease, it makes sense to put it in yeast because it's a much simpler organism and you can do a lot of genetic manipulation in a much much more easily than you can in humans, right? So I was super excited about this idea. I came in and said, I want to work with that. And I started reading because I want to work with that, but I don't know what I'm going to do. I have no idea what I'm going to be doing. And Joris was a good mentor in the sense that he was very, I did thrive a lot with these very hands-off mentors in a sense. They were like, here's the tools, here's the library, figure it out.
Oh, that's great.
Right? So I came in and I had no idea what to do and started reading about Parkinson, and that brought me down a rabbit hole. I was like, well, Parkinson is a disease of aging. Now you get Parkinson when you get older. So it's the same thing with Alzheimer's. You also had a model where you had like a tau, which is a protein involved in Alzheimer's in yeast, kind of like the same idea, same basic concept. And at some point I stumbled upon papers that were talking about researching aging in yeast, right? Mm-hmm. And I talked about a little bit about that before. I talked about this replicative lifespan mm-hmm. paradigm, you know, where you take have the mother cell, you take away the mother cells with each replication, you count how many replications the cell make. There's another kind of experiment that you can do for longevity in yeast, which is called chronological lifespan. Mm. And that's a kind of experiment that was developed in the laboratory of a countrymate of mine, actually, Walter Longo, down at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. He was the one who developed this kind of experiment. You basically you take yeast, and yeast behaves like any microorganisms in a culture. So you can put it in a medium, in a liquid broth with a lot of nutrients. The yeast will eat up the nutrients until there are no more nutrients, and then you have this biomass of yeast that just sits there and waits, right? Mm-hmm. And what you can do is you can keep it there, and every couple of days you ask how many of these yeast cells in this spent culture are still alive, right? So you take a little bit of this yeast, you plate it onto a rich medium plate, and you count how many colonies pop up. You know how many cells you put in. You look at how many cells make a colony. The difference is your viability, right? And with time, every couple of days, more and more of those cells die. Right, so you can think of that as way of modeling aging for cells that don't divide anymore. So, if replicative lifespan is a way of modeling aging for cells that do divide, now mm-hmm. because you count every time a cell actually does divide, the chronological lifespan was thought of a way to measure how long a cell would be viable in its environment. Right. It's more complicated than that, of course. There's yes. been a lot of experiments that have been done that kind of shown the chronological lifespan is influenced by external conditions like the pH of the medium, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. I didn't know any of that at the time. It actually hadn't been done at the time. And mm-hmm. I was like, wow, this is a fantastic way of modeling aging of neurons mm-hmm. Using yeast, because neurons don't divide. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at something that basically makes neurons sick, because alpha-synuclein causes Parkinson. Parkinson is a neuronal problem, right? What a fantastic experiment to do with this yeast line, not with the yeast transgenic that has alpha-synuclein. And that's what I did, mm-hmm. okay? And sure enough, the yeast with alpha-synuclein would live a lot less long, was a lot shorter lived than the normal yeast, right?
Interesting.
Uh-huh. And so we tried to figure out what was happening. But again, I was saying, one of the great things that you can do with yeast is that it's very easy to do genetic manipulation. So uh-huh. it's very easy to knock out a gene or put in another gene or activate a gene considerably, so it's always active, et cetera, right? What we found out was, and actually I did not find out that, the first author of the paper found out that, because I was too busy partying all night when I was in Belgium. It was great because I was doing science during the day and I was out having a good time at night.
Oh, that's a nice
if
one.
I had, I don't know if I would have had like the first authorship on that paper if I had partied a little less at night. But honestly, I don't regret it. So
that's great.
What we found out eventually was that if you take away mitochondrial function mm-hmm. in yeast, so you can yeast actually is particular because it can grow without functional mitochondria. No, mm-hmm. it will just do fermentation, mm-hmm. which is what yeast does when it makes beer, for example.
Right.
No, because it ferments your sugar into alcohol and that's it. Mm-hmm. Which is why oxygen, air, not in the process of making beer is really bad, right? Because you end up just making the whole thing sour instead of making it alcoholic, right? Anyway, if you take away mitochondrial function from yeast. Yeast is viable. It's just not particularly long lived. It's a little mm-hmm. sick, makes these like little tiny colonies. We call it petite, right? Mm-hmm. So if you take a petite yeast, then alpha-synuclein doesn't do anything. Mm. The yeast with alpha-synuclein lives just as long as the petite yeast without alpha-synuclein, which they both live a lot shorter So that's a confounding factor in the experiment, if you want. But at least there's no toxic effect of alpha-synuclein in that particular strain. So that kind of tells you that on some fundamental level, having alpha-synuclein messes up your mitochondria.
Yeah.
Having alpha-synuclein, especially having alpha-synuclein aggregating into the so-called neurofibrillary tangles, which are part of the way.
That's Alzheimer's.
The neurofibrillary tangles, again, this is so long. I never remember if, it's the Lewy bodies that alpha-synuclein makes. Neurofibrillary tangles is tau, right?
Yes.
So having alpha-synuclein aggregates in the Lewy bodies, these aggregates, these insoluble aggregates in the yeast, messes up your mitochondria. And that's why it's toxic. If you take away the mitochondria, alpha-synuclein is not toxic anymore. You're not as longer lived as you would have been, but at least alpha-synuclein is not doing anything. So this tells you on a fundamental level that mitochondria are important in Parkinson's disease, which is something that we knew already because you can get Parkinson's disease from mitochondrial poison, but it was another interesting way of finding that out.
But it's important because even when we treat when we treat Parkinson's now, we don't think of mitochondria as a particular target for treatment.
No, yeah, I think is levodopa still the standard of care for Parkinson, basically? Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, my dad had Parkinson early stages he didn't live long enough to see it like really go down south. But he was starting to not be particularly present. And then it went on levodopa and it was working great.
Oh,
it was so happy about the levodopa. It was just, it's fantastic. Yep. I feel like young again. Yeah. But then at some point it stops working. Right. So
that's right. Fascinating. Yeah. Okay. So I think we've covered everything that was on my list from what we had talked about. We got cellular senescence. We got mitochondria. We got the Krebs cycle and oxidative stress and respiratory determination of energy and ATP. We've talked about how the microbiome impacts mitochondria and aging with rapamycin, the acarbose, and the butyrate, one of the butyric acids or butyrate, one of the short chain fatty acids. And then we kind of looped back to your beginning, talking about the yeast and the alpha-synuclein and mitochondrial dysfunction and Parkinson's in a Parkinson's model. So this has been awesome.
Yeah, no, it's been fun. Also going back memory lane that was a fun time. I hope I didn't ramble too much and go off the tangent.
No, the tangents are perfect because that's what is so interesting about science that you don't get when you read the paper or when you that's part of necessarily just the lecture about cellular senescence is the history and the stories and the discoveries and all of the intricacies of how these things interrelate. So this has been perfect. And the things that you're interrelating in your lab are the things that are the ways that we're working on health clinically, at the bedside. So we say bench to bedside. So this podcast has been sort of a bench to bedside kind of podcast, right? So metabolic dysfunction, mitochondrial dysfunction, aging, anti-aging. And we talk about anti-aging in the clinical world, right? Anti-aging is like Botox and fillers and really true anti-aging from the Ayurvedic perspective, which is what my training has been, is really about metabolic rejuvenation and restoration. And so that's what happens when you have the right amount of food, oxygen, sleep, all those components.
Yeah, I mean, a healthy lifestyle is definitely important. But what I think on some sense, what I'm trying to distill what the healthy lifestyle means in terms of like little molecules floating around in your body, right?
Yes, exactly. And what are the tools that we have? Because we don't necessarily think of the microbiome as an anti-aging tool, but absolutely we see at the bench in the research it is.
I think it's a little early to say that it is, but I think it's definitely like exciting to think that it could be, right? And that there might be something there not worth looking at.
Yes. Yes. That so far the research is positive enough to continue doing it. Mm-hmm. So good.
Yeah. Well, if you want to circle back again a little bit, just like kind of like a closure there on the microbiome, one of the things that rapamycin seems to be doing, at least in one experiment, again, it's one experiment with one strain of mice and actually kind of small number that we did in 2016, came up in 2016, we actually saw some alterations in the microbiome of old mice that were treated with rapamycin for 3 months. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty fun. We were kind of excited about that too. We never followed up on that, but that's another sort of like that's another premise over which we can try and construct a an argument over why we should look at the microbiome in aging, right? It could be important.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you all for listening today with Dr. Alessandro Bitto. We've got lots of ways to continue this conversation through Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can get more information from and about us at our website, centerforhealingneurology.com. And please be sure to share this show with your friends. We welcome your rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. And feel free to send your topic requests to podcast@centerforhealingneurology.com. We love that you've joined us today to discuss how to make our whole world medicine. We rise or fall together, and we're committed to doing what we can to make as many of us as healthy as possible. And this takes all of us, including you. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Party Fish Media acknowledges that it operates and records on Indigenous Duwamish and Puget Sound Coast Salish land that is still home to the Duwamish tribe. This land is stolen in violation of the Point Elliott Treaty of 1855. We are committed to uplifting the name of these lands and community members from these nations who reside alongside us. For more information on this land, its people, or ways you can help, visit duwamishtribe.org.